Chapter 9 Continued. The school talked of nothing but Sirius Black for the next few days. The theories about how he had entered the castle became wilder and wilder. Hannah Abbott from Hufflepuff spent much of their next herbology class telling anyone who'd listen that Black could turn into a flowering shrub. The fat lady's ripped canvas had been taken off the wall and replaced with the portrait of Sir Cadogan and his fat grey pony. Nobody was very happy about this. Sir Cadogan spent half his time challenging people to duels, and the rest thinking up ridiculously complicated passwords, which he changed at least twice a day. "He's barking mad," said Seamus Finnegan angrily to Percy. "Can't we get anyone else?" "None of the other pictures wanted the job," said Percy. "Frightened of what happened to the fat lady, Sir Cadogan was the only one brave enough to volunteer." Sir Cadogan, however, was the least of Harry's worries. He was now being closely watched. Teachers found excuses to walk along corridors with him, and Percy Weasley, acting, Harry suspected, on his mother's orders, was tailing him everywhere like an extremely pompous guard dog. To cap it all, Professor McGonagall summoned Harry into her office with such a sombre expression on her face, Harry thought someone must have died. "There's no point hiding it from you any longer, Potter," she said in a very serious voice. "I know this will come as a shock to you, but Sirius Black—" "I know he's after me," said Harry wearily. "I heard Ron's dad telling his mum. Mr. Weasley works for the Ministry of Magic." Professor McGonagall seemed very taken aback. She stared at Harry for a moment or two, then said, "I see. Well, in that case, Potter, you'll understand why I don't think it's a good idea for you to be practising Quidditch in the evenings. Out on the pitch with only your team members, it's very exposed, Potter." "We've got our first match on Saturday," said Harry, outraged. "I've got to train, Professor." Professor McGonagall considered him intently. Harry knew she was deeply interested in the Gryffindor team's prospects. It had been she, after all, who'd suggested him as seeker in the first place. He waited, holding his breath. Professor McGonagall stood up and stared out of the window at the Quidditch pitch, just visible through the rain. "Well, goodness knows I'd like to see us win the cup at last. But all the same, Potter, I'd be happier if a teacher were present. I'll ask Madam Hooch to oversee your training sessions." The weather worsened steadily as the first Quidditch match drew nearer. Undaunted, the Gryffindor team were training harder than ever under the eye of Madam Hooch. Then, at their final training session before Saturday's match, Oliver Wood gave his team some unwelcome news. "We're not playing Slytherin," he told them, looking very angry. "Flint's just been to see me. We're playing Hufflepuff instead." "Why?" chorused the rest of the team. "Flint's excuse is that their seeker's arm's still injured," said Wood, grinding his teeth furiously. "But it's obvious why they're doing it. Don't want to play in this weather. Think it'll damage their chances." There had been strong winds and heavy rain all day, and as Wood spoke, they heard a distant rumble of thunder. "There's nothing wrong with Malfoy's arm," said Harry furiously. "He's faking it." "I know that, but we can't prove it," said Wood bitterly. "And we've been practising all those moves, assuming we're playing Slytherin, and instead it's Hufflepuff, and their style's quite different. They've got a new captain and seeker, Cedric Diggory." Angelina, Alicia and Katie suddenly giggled. "What?" said Wood, frowning at this light-hearted behaviour.
"He's that tall, good-looking one, isn't he?" said Angelina. "Strong and silent," said Katie, and they started to giggle again.
"He's only silent because he's too thick to string two words together," said Fred impatiently. "I don't know why you're worried, Oliver. Hufflepuff are a pushover. Last time we played them, Harry caught the snitch in about 5 minutes, remember?" "We were playing in completely different conditions," Wood shouted, his eyes bulging slightly. "Diggory's put a very strong side together. He's an excellent seeker. I was afraid you'd take it like this. We mustn't relax. We must keep our focus. Slytherin are trying to wrong-foot us. We must win."
"Oliver, calm down," said Fred, looking slightly alarmed. "We're taking Hufflepuff very seriously. Seriously." The day before the match, the winds reached howling point, and the rain fell harder than ever. It was so dark inside the corridors and classrooms that extra torches and lanterns were lit. The Slytherin team were looking very smug indeed, and none more so than Malfoy.
"Ah, if only my arm were feeling a bit better," he sighed, as the gale outside pounded the windows.
Harry had no room in his head to worry about anything except the match next day. Oliver Wood kept hurrying up to him between classes and giving him tips. The third time this happened, Wood talked for so long that Harry suddenly realized he was 10 minutes late for Defense Against the Dark Arts and set off at a run with Wood shouting after him, "Diggory's got a very fast swerve, Harry, so you might want to try looping him." Harry skidded to a halt outside the Defense Against the Dark Arts classroom, pulled the door open, and dashed inside. "Sorry I'm late, Professor Lupin. I..." But it wasn't Professor Lupin who looked up at him from the teacher's desk. It was Snape.
"This lesson began 10 minutes ago, Potter, so I think we'll make it 10 points from Gryffindor. Sit down."
But Harry didn't move.
"Where's Professor Lupin?" he said.
"He says he's feeling too ill to teach today," said Snape with a twisted smile. "I believe I told you to sit down." But Harry stayed where he was.
"What's wrong with him?"
Snape's black eyes glittered.
"Nothing life-threatening," he said, looking as though he wished it was. 5 more points from Gryffindor, and if I have to ask you to sit down again, it will be 50."
Harry walked slowly to his seat and sat down. Snape looked around at the class.
"As I was saying before Potter interrupted, Professor Lupin has not left any record of the topics you have covered so far."
"Please, sir, we've done Boggarts, Redcaps, Cappers, and Grindylows," said Hermione quickly, "and we're just about to start..."
"Be quiet," said Snape coldly. "I did not ask for information. I was merely commenting on Professor Lupin's lack of organization." "He's the best Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher we've ever had," said Dean Thomas boldly, and there was a murmur of agreement from the rest of the class. Snape looked more menacing than ever.
"You are easily satisfied? Lupin is hardly overtaxing you. I would expect first years to be able to deal with Redcaps and Grindylows. Today we shall discuss..."
Harry watched him flick through the textbook to the very back chapter, which he must know they hadn't covered.
"Werewolves," said Snape.
"But, sir," said Hermione, seemingly unable to restrain herself, "we're not supposed to do werewolves yet. We're due to start Hinkypunks."
"Miss Granger," said Snape in a voice of deadly calm, "I was under the impression that I was taking this lesson, not you, and I am telling you all to turn to page 394. He glanced around again. "All of you! Now!" With many bitter, sidelong looks and some sullen muttering, the class opened their books. "Which of you can tell me how we distinguish between the werewolf and the true wolf?" said Snape. Everyone sat in motionless silence. Everyone except Hermione, whose hand, as it so often did, had shot straight into the air.
"Anyone?" Snape said, ignoring Hermione. His twisted smile was back.
"Are you telling me that Professor Lupin hasn't even taught you the basic distinction between..."
"We told you," said Parvati suddenly. "We haven't got as far as werewolves yet. We're still on..."
"Silence!" snarled Snape. "Well, well, well. I never thought I'd meet a third-year class who wouldn't even recognize a werewolf when they saw one. I shall make a point of informing Professor Dumbledore how very behind you all are."
"Please, sir," said Hermione, whose hand was still in the air, "the werewolf differs from the true wolf in several small ways. The snout of the werewolf..."
"That is the second time you have spoken out of turn, Miss Granger," said Snape coolly. 5 more points from Gryffindor for being an insufferable know-it-all."
Hermione went very red, put down her hand, and stared at the floor with her eyes full of tears. it was a mark of how much the class loathed Snape that they were all glaring at him, because every one of them had called Hermione a know-it-all at least once, and Ron, who told Hermione she was a know-it-all at least twice a week, said loudly, "You asked us a question and she knows the answer. Why ask if you don't want to be told?" The class knew instantly he had gone too far. Snape advanced on Ron slowly, and the room held its breath. "Detention, Weasley," Snape said silkily, his face very close to Ron's. "And if I ever hear you criticize the way I teach a class again, you will be very sorry indeed." No one made a sound throughout the rest of the lesson. They sat and made notes on werewolves from the textbook, while Snape prowled up and down the rows of desks, examining the work they had been doing with Professor Lupin. "Very poorly explained. That is incorrect. The kappa is more commonly found in Mongolia. Professor Lupin gave this 8 out of 10. I wouldn't have given it 3. When the bell rang at last, Snape held them back. "You will each write an essay to be handed in to me on the ways you recognize and kill werewolves. I want 2 rolls of parchment on the subject, and I want them by Monday morning. It is time somebody took this class in hand. Weasley, stay behind. We need to arrange your detention." Harry and Hermione left the room with the rest of the class, who waited until they were well out of earshot, then burst into a furious tirade about Snape. "Snape's never been like this with any of our other Defence Against the Dark Arts teachers, even if he did want the job," Harry said to Hermione. "Why has he got it in for Lupin? Do you think this is all because of the boggart?" "I don't know," said Hermione pensively, "but I really hope Professor Lupin gets better soon." Ron caught up with them 5 minutes later in a towering rage. "Do you know what that—" he called Snape something that made Hermione say, "Ron! Is making me do? I've got to scrub out the bedpans in the hospital wing without magic." He was breathing deeply, his fists clenched. "Why couldn't Black have hidden in Snape's office, eh? He could have finished him off for us." Harry woke extremely early next morning, so early that it was still dark. For a moment he thought the roaring of the wind had woken him. Then he felt a cold breeze on the back of his neck and sat bolt upright. Peeves the poltergeist had been floating next to him, blowing hard in his ear. "What did he do that for?" said Harry furiously. Peeves puffed out his cheeks, blew hard, and zoomed backwards out of the room, cackling. Harry fumbled for his alarm clock and looked at it. It was 4:30. Cursing Peeves, he rolled over and tried to get back to sleep. But it was very difficult, now he was awake, to ignore the sounds of the thunder rumbling overhead, the pounding of the wind against the castle walls, and the distant creaking of the trees in the Forbidden Forest. In a few hours he would be out on the Quidditch pitch, battling through that gale. Finally he gave up any more thought of sleep, got up, dressed, picked up his Nimbus 2000, and walked quietly out of the dormitory. As Harry opened the door, something brushed against his leg. He bent down just in time to grab Crookshanks by the end of his bushy tail and drag him outside. "You know, I reckon Ron was right about you," Harry told Crookshanks suspiciously. "There are plenty of mice around this place. Go and chase them." "Go on," he added, nudging Crookshanks down the spiral staircase with his foot. "Leave Scabbers alone." The noise of the storm was even louder in the common room. Harry knew better than to think the match would be cancelled. Quidditch matches weren't called off for trifles such as thunderstorms. Nevertheless, he was starting to feel very apprehensive. Wood had pointed out Cedric Diggory to him in the corridor. Diggory was a fifth year and a lot bigger than Harry. Seekers were usually light and speedy, but Diggory's weight would be an advantage in this weather because he was less likely to be blown off course. Harry whiled away the hours until dawn in front of the fire, getting up every now and then to stop Crookshanks sneaking up the boys' staircase again. At long last, Harry thought it must be time for breakfast, so he headed through the portrait hole alone.
"Stand up and fight, you mangy cur!" yelled Sir Cadogan.
"Oh, shut up," Harry yawned. he revived a bit over a large bowl of porridge, and by the time he'd started on toast, the rest of the team had turned up.
"It's going to be a tough one," said Wood, who wasn't eating anything.
"Stop worrying, Oliver," said Alicia soothingly. "We don't mind a bit of rain."
But it was considerably more than a bit of rain. Such was the popularity of Quidditch that the whole school turned out to watch the match as usual, but they ran down the lawns towards the Quidditch pitch, heads bowed against the ferocious wind, umbrellas being whipped out of their hands as they went. Just before he entered the changing room, Harry saw Malfoy, Crabbe and Goyle laughing and pointing at him from under an enormous umbrella on their way to the stadium. The team changed into their scarlet robes and waited for Wood's usual pre-match pep talk. But it didn't come. He tried to speak several times, made an odd gulping noise, then shook his head hopelessly and beckoned them to follow him. The wind was so strong that they staggered sideways as they walked out onto the pitch. If the crowd was cheering, they couldn't hear it over the fresh rolls of thunder. Rain was splattering over Harry's glasses. How on earth was he going to see the Snitch in this? The Hufflepuffs were approaching from the opposite side of the pitch, wearing canary yellow robes. The captains walked up to each other and shook hands. Diggory smiled at Wood, but Wood now looked as though he had lockjaw and merely nodded. Harry saw Madame Hooch's mouth form the words, "Mount your brooms." He pulled his right foot out of the mud with a squelch and swung it over his Nimbus 2000. Madame Hooch put her whistle to her lips and gave it a blast that sounded shrill and distant. They were off. Harry rose fast, but his Nimbus was swerving slightly with the wind. He held it as steady as he could and turned, squinting into the rain. Within 5 minutes, Harry was soaked to his skin and frozen, hardly able to see his teammates, let alone the tiny Snitch. He flew backwards and forwards across the pitch, past blurred red and yellow shapes, with no idea of what was happening in the rest of the game. He couldn't hear the commentary over the wind. The crowd was hidden beneath a sea of cloaks and battered umbrellas. Twice, Harry came very close to being unseated by a bludger. His vision was so clouded by the rain on his glasses, he hadn't seen them coming. He lost track of time. It was getting harder and harder to hold his broom straight. The sky was getting darker, as though night had decided to come early. Twice, Harry nearly hit another player, without knowing whether it was a teammate or opponent. Everyone was now so wet and the rain so thick, he could hardly tell them apart. With the first flash of lightning came the sound of Madame Hooch's whistle. Harry could just see the outline of Wood through the thick rain, gesturing him to the ground. The whole team splashed down into the mud.
"I called for time out!" Wood roared at his team. "Come on, under here!"
They huddled at the edge of the pitch under a large umbrella. Harry took off his glasses and wiped them hurriedly on his robes.
"What's the score?"
"We're 50 points up," said Wood, "but unless we get the Snitch soon, we'll be playing into the night."
"I've got no chance with these on," Harry said exasperatedly, waving his glasses.
At that very moment, Hermione appeared at his shoulder. She was holding her cloak over her head and was, inexplicably, beaming.
"I've had an idea, Harry. Give me your glasses, quick."
He handed them to her, and, as the team watched in amazement, Hermione tapped them with her wand and said,
"Impervious!"
"There," she said, handing them back to Harry. "They'll repel water." Wood looked as though he could have kissed her.
"Brilliant!"
he called hoarsely after her as she disappeared into the crowd.
"Okay, team, let's go for it."
Hermione's spell had done the trick. Harry was still numb with cold, still wetter than he'd ever been in his life, but he could see. Full of fresh determination, he urged his broom through the turbulent air, staring in every direction for the Snitch, avoiding a bludger, ducking beneath Diggory, who was streaking in the opposite direction. There was another clap of thunder, followed immediately by forked lightning. This was getting more and more dangerous. Harry needed to get the Snitch quickly. He turned, intending to head back towards the middle of the pitch, but at that moment another flash of lightning illuminated the stands, and Harry saw something that distracted him completely. The silhouette of an enormous, shaggy black dog, clearly imprinted against the sky, motionless in the topmost empty row of seats. Harry's numb hands slipped on the broom handle, and his nimbus dropped a few feet. Shaking his sodden fringe out of his eyes, he squinted back into the stands. The dog had vanished.
"Harry!" came Wood's anguished yell from the Gryffindor goalposts. "Harry, behind you!"
Harry looked wildly around. Cedric Diggory was pelting up the pitch, and a tiny speck of gold was shimmering in the rain-filled air between them. With a jolt of panic, Harry threw himself flat to the broom handle and zoomed towards the snitch.
"Come on!" he growled at his nimbus as the rain whipped his face. "Faster!"
But something odd was happening. An eerie silence was falling across the stadium. The wind, though as strong as ever, was forgetting to roar. It was as though someone had turned off the sound, as though Harry had gone suddenly deaf. What was going on? And then a horribly familiar wave of cold swept over him, inside him, just as he became aware of something moving on the pitch below. Before he'd had time to think, Harry had taken his eyes off the snitch and looked down. At least 100 Dementors, their hidden faces pointing up at him, were standing below. It was as though freezing water was rising in his chest, cutting at his insides. And then he heard it again. Someone was screaming, screaming inside his head. A woman.
"Not Harry! Not Harry! Please, not Harry!"
"Stand aside, you silly girl! Stand aside now!"
"Not Harry! Please, no! Take me! Kill me instead!"
Numbing, swirling white mist was filling Harry's brain. What was he doing? Why was he flying? He needed to help her. She was going to die. She was going to be murdered. He was falling, falling through the icy mist.
"Not Harry! Please, have mercy! Have mercy!"
A shrill voice was laughing. The woman was screaming, and Harry knew no more.
Lucky the ground was so soft. I thought he was dead for sure. But he didn't even break his glasses.
Harry could hear the voices whispering, but they made no sense whatsoever. He didn't have a clue where he was, or how he had got there, or what he'd been doing before he got there. All he knew was that every inch of him was aching as though it had been beaten.
That was the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life. Scariest, the scariest thing, hooded black figures, cold, screaming.
Harry's eyes snapped open. He was lying in the hospital wing. The Gryffindor Quidditch team, spattered with mud from head to foot, was gathered around his bed. Ron and Hermione were also there, looking as though they'd just climbed out of a swimming pool.
"Harry," said Fred, who looked extremely white underneath the mud, "how are you feeling?"
It was as though Harry's memory was on fast forward. The lightning, the grim, the snitch, and the Dementors.
"What happened?" he said, sitting up so suddenly they all gasped.
"You fell off," said Fred. "Must have been, what, 50 feet?
"We thought you'd died," said Alicia, who was shaking.
Hermione made a small, squeaky noise. Her eyes were extremely bloodshot.
"But the match," said Harry. "What happened? Are we having a replay?"
No one said anything. The horrible truth sank into Harry like a stone.
"We didn't lose."
"Diggory got the snitch," said George. "Just after you fell, he didn't realize what had happened. When he looked back and saw you on the ground, he tried to call it off, wanted a rematch. But they won, fair and square. Even Wood admits it."
"Where is Wood?" said Harry, suddenly realizing he wasn't there.
"Still in the showers," said Fred. "We think he's trying to drown himself." Harry put his face to his knees, his hands gripping his hair. Fred grabbed his shoulder and shook it roughly.
"Come on, Harry, you've never missed the snitch before."
"There had to be one time you didn't get it," said George.
"It's not over yet," said Fred.
"We lost by 100 points, right? So if Hufflepuff lose to Ravenclaw and we beat Ravenclaw and Slytherin, Hufflepuff will have to lose by at least 200 points, said George.
"But if they beat Ravenclaw..." "No way! Ravenclaw are too good. But if Slytherin lose against Hufflepuff..."
"It all depends on the points. A margin of 100 either way..."
Harry lay there, not saying a word. They had lost. For the first time ever, he had lost a Quidditch match.
After 10 minutes or so, Madame Pomfrey came over to tell the team to leave him in peace.
"We'll come and see you later," Fred told him. "Don't beat yourself up, Harry. You're still the best seeker we've ever had."
The team trooped out, trailing mud behind them. Madame Pomfrey shut the door behind them, looking disapproving. Ron and Hermione moved nearer to Harry's bed.
"Dumbledore was really angry," Hermione said in a quaking voice. "I've never seen him like that before. He ran onto the pitch as you fell, waved his wand, and you sort of slowed down before you hit the ground. Then he whirled his wand at the Dementors, shot silver stuff at them. They left the stadium straight away. He was furious they'd come into the grounds. We heard him."
"Then he magicked you onto a stretcher," said Ron, "and walked up to school with you floating on it. Everyone thought you were..."
His voice faded away, but Harry hardly noticed. He was thinking about what the Dementors had done to him, about the screaming voice. He looked up and saw Ron and Hermione looking at him so anxiously that he quickly cast around for something matter-of-fact to say.
"Did someone get my Nimbus?"
Ron and Hermione looked quickly at each other.
What?
Said Harry, looking from one to the other.
"Well, when you fell off, it got blown away," said Hermione hesitantly.
"And?"
"And it hit the Whomping Willow."
Harry's insides lurched. The Whomping Willow was a very violent tree which stood alone in the middle of the grounds.
"And?" he said, dreading the answer. "Well, you know the Whomping Willow," said Ron. It doesn't like being hit."
"Professor Flitwick brought it back just before you came round," said Hermione in a very small voice.
Slowly she reached down for a bag at her feet, turned it upside down, and tipped a dozen bits of splintered wood and twig onto the bed, the only remains of Harry's faithful, finally beaten broomstick. Chapter 10. The Marauder's Map. Madame Pomfrey insisted on keeping Harry in the hospital wing for the rest of the weekend. He didn't argue or complain, but he wouldn't let her throw away the shattered remnants of his Nimbus 2000. He knew he was being stupid, knew that the Nimbus was beyond repair, but Harry couldn't help it. He felt as though he'd lost one of his best friends. He had a stream of visitors, all intent on cheering him up. Hagrid sent him a bunch of earwiggy flowers that looked like yellow cabbages, and Ginny Weasley, blushing furiously, turned up with a get-well card she had made herself, which sang shrilly unless Harry kept it shut under his bowl of fruit. The Gryffindor team visited again on Sunday morning, this time accompanied by Wood, who told Harry, in a hollow, dead sort of voice, that he didn't blame him in the slightest. Ron and Hermione only left Harry's bedside at night. But nothing anyone said or did could make Harry feel any better, because they only knew half of what was troubling him. He hadn't told anyone about the Grim, not even Ron and Hermione, because he knew Ron would panic and Hermione would scoff. The fact remained, however, that it had now appeared twice, and both appearances had been followed by near-fatal accidents. The first time, he had nearly been run over by the night bus. The second, fallen 50 feet from his broomstick. Was the Grim going to haunt him until he actually died? Was he going to spend the rest of his life looking over his shoulder for the beast? And then there were the Dementors. Harry felt sick and humiliated every time he thought of them. Everyone said the Dementors were horrible, but no one else collapsed every time they went near one. No one else heard echoes in their head of their dying parents. For Harry knew who that screaming voice belonged to now. He had heard her words, heard them over and over again during the night hours in the hospital wing while he lay awake, staring at the strips of moonlight on the ceiling. When the Dementors approached him, he heard the last moments of his mother's life, her attempts to protect him, Harry, from Lord Voldemort, and Voldemort's laughter before he murdered her. Harry dozed fitfully, sinking into dreams full of clammy, rotted hands and petrified pleading, jerking awake only to dwell again on the sound of his mother's voice. It was a relief to return on Monday to the noise and bustle of the main school, where he was forced to think about other things, even if he had to endure Draco Malfoy's taunting. Malfoy was almost beside himself with glee at Gryffindor's defeat. He had finally taken off his bandages and celebrated having the full use of both arms again by doing spirited imitations of Harry falling off his broom. Malfoy spent much of their next potions class doing Dementor imitations across the dungeon. Ron finally cracked, flinging a large, slippery crocodile heart at Malfoy, which hit him in the face and caused Snape to take 50 points from Gryffindor. "If Snape's taking defence against the dark arts again, I'm going off sick," said Ron, as they headed towards Lupin's classroom after lunch. "Check who's in there, Hermione." Hermione peered around the classroom door. "It's okay." Professor Lupin was back at work. It certainly looked as though he had been ill. His old robes were hanging more loosely on him, and there were dark shadows beneath his eyes. Nevertheless, he smiled at the class as they took their seats, and they burst at once into an explosion of complaints about Snape's behaviour while Lupin had been ill. "It's not fair. He was only filling in. Why should he set us homework? We don't know anything about werewolves. 2 rolls of parchment!" "Did you tell Professor Snape we haven't covered them yet?" Lupin asked, frowning slightly. The babble broke out again. "Yes, but he said we were really behind. He wouldn't listen. 2 rolls of parchment!" Professor Lupin smiled at the look of indignation on every face. "Don't worry. I'll speak to Professor Snape. You don't have to do the essay." "Oh, no!" said Hermione, looking very disappointed. "I've already finished it." They had a very enjoyable lesson. Professor Lupin had brought along a glass box containing a hinky-punk, a little one-legged creature who seemed as though he was made of wisps of smoke, rather frail and harmless-looking. "Lures travellers into bogs," said Professor Lupin, as they took notes. "You notice the lantern dangling from his hand. Hops ahead. People follow the light. Then..." The hinky-punk made a horrible squelching noise against the glass. When the bell rang, everyone gathered up their things and headed for the door, Harry amongst them. But, "Wait a moment, Harry," Lupin called. "I'd like a word." Harry doubled back and watched Professor Lupin covering the hinky-punk's box with a cloth. "I heard about the match," said Lupin, turning back to his desk and starting to pile books into his briefcase. "And I'm sorry about your broomstick. Is there any chance of fixing it?" "No," said Harry. "The tree smashed it to bits." Lupin sighed. "They planted the Whomping Willow the same year that I arrived at Hogwarts. People used to play a game, trying to get near enough to touch the trunk. In the end, a boy called Davy Gudgeon nearly lost an eye, and we were forbidden to go near it. No broomstick would have a chance."
"Did you hear about the Dementors, too?" said Harry, with difficulty.
Lupin looked at him quickly.
"Yes, I did. I don't think any of us have seen Professor Dumbledore that angry. They have been growing restless for some time, furious at his refusal to let them inside the grounds. I suppose they were the reason you fell?"
"Yes," said Harry.
He hesitated, and then the question he had to ask burst from him before he could stop himself. "Why? Why do they affect me like that? Am I just—"
"It has nothing to do with weakness," said Professor Lupin sharply, as though he had read Harry's mind. "The Dementors affect you worse than the others, because there are horrors in your past that the others don't have." A ray of wintry sunlight fell across the classroom, illuminating Lupin's grey hairs and the lines on his young face. Dementors are among the foulest creatures that walk this earth. They infest the darkest, filthiest places. They glory in decay and despair. They drain peace, hope, and happiness out of the air around them. Even muggles feel their presence, though they can't see them. Get too near a Dementor, and every good feeling, every happy memory, will be sucked out of you. If it can, the Dementor will feed on you long enough to reduce you to something like itself, soulless and evil. You'll be left with nothing but the worst experiences of your life. And the worst that has happened to you, Harry, is enough to make anyone fall off their broom. You have nothing to feel ashamed of. When they get near me, Harry stared at Lupin's desk, his throat tight, I can hear Voldemort murdering my mum. Lupin made a sudden motion with his arm, as though he had made to grip Harry's shoulder, but thought better of it. There was a moment's silence. Then,
why did they have to come to the match? Said Harry bitterly.
They're getting hungry, said Lupin coolly, shutting his briefcase with a snap. Dumbledore won't let them into the school, so their supply of human prey has dried up. I don't think they could resist the large crowd around the Quidditch pitch. All that excitement, emotions running high. It was their idea of a feast.
Azkaban must be terrible, Harry muttered. Lupin nodded grimly.
The fortress is set on a tiny island way out to sea. But they don't need walls and water to keep the prisoners in. Not when they're all trapped inside their own heads, incapable of a single cheerful thought. Most of them go mad within weeks.
But Sirius Black escaped from them, Harry said slowly. He got away.
Lupin's briefcase slipped from the desk. He had to stoop quickly to catch it.
Yes, he said, straightening up. Black must have found a way to fight them. I wouldn't have believed it possible. Dementors are supposed to drain a wizard of his powers if he is left with them too long.
You made that Dementor on the train back off, said Harry suddenly.
There are certain defences one can use, said Lupin, but there was only one Dementor on the train. The more there are, the more difficult it becomes to resist.
What defences? Said Harry at once. Can you teach me?
Oh, I don't pretend to be an expert at fighting Dementors, Harry, quite the contrary.
But if the Dementors come to another Quidditch match, I need to be able to fight them.
Lupin looked into Harry's determined face, hesitated, then said,
Well, all right, I'll try and help. But it'll have to wait until next term, I'm afraid. I have a lot to do before the holidays. I chose a very inconvenient time to fall ill.
What with the promise of anti-Dementor lessons from Lupin, the thought that he might never have to hear his mother's death again, and the fact that Ravenclaw flattened Hufflepuff in their Quidditch match at the end of November, Harry's mood took a definite upturn. Gryffindor were not out of the running after all, although they could not afford to lose another match. Wood became repossessed of his manic energy and worked his team as hard as ever in the chilly haze of rain that persisted into December. Harry saw no hint of a Dementor within the grounds. Dumbledore's anger seemed to be keeping them at their stations at the entrances. 2 weeks before the end of term, the sky lightened suddenly to a dazzling opaline white, and the muddy grounds were revealed one morning covered in glittering frost. Inside the castle there was a buzz of Christmas in the air. Professor Flitwick, the charms teacher, had already decorated his classroom with shimmering lights that turned out to be real, fluttering fairies. The students were all happily discussing their plans for the holidays. Both Ron and Hermione had decided to remain at Hogwarts, and though Ron said it was because he couldn't stand 2 weeks with Percy, and Hermione insisted she needed to use the library, Harry wasn't fooled. They were doing it to keep him company, and he was very grateful. To everyone's delight, except Harry's, there was to be another Hogsmeade trip on the very last weekend of term.
"We can do all our Christmas shopping there," said Hermione. "Mum and Dad would really love those tooth-flossing string mints from Honeydukes."
resigned to the fact that he would be the only third year staying behind again, Harry borrowed a copy of Witch Broomstick from Wood and decided to spend the day reading up on the different makes. He had been riding one of the school brooms at team practice, an ancient shooting star, which was very slow and jerky. He definitely needed a new broom of his own. On the Saturday morning of the Hogsmeade trip, Harry bid goodbye to Ron and Hermione, who were wrapped in cloaks and scarves, then turned up the marble staircase alone and headed back towards Gryffindor Tower. Snow had started to fall outside the windows, and the castle was very still and quiet.
"Psst! Harry!"
He turned, halfway along the third-floor corridor, to see Fred and George peering out at him from behind a statue of a hump-backed, one-eyed witch.
"What are you doing?" said Harry curiously. "How come you're not going to Hogsmeade?"
"We've come to give you a bit of festive cheer before we go," said Fred with a mysterious wink. "Come in here."
He nodded towards an empty classroom to the left of the one-eyed statue. Harry followed Fred and George inside. George closed the door quietly and then turned, beaming, to look at Harry.
"Early Christmas present for you, Harry," he said.
Fred pulled something from inside his cloak with a flourish and laid it on one of the desks. It was a large, square, very worn piece of parchment with nothing written on it. Harry, suspecting one of Fred and George's jokes, stared at it.
"What's that supposed to be?"
"This, Harry, is the secret of our success," said George, patting the parchment fondly.
"It's a wrench giving it to you," said Fred, "but we decided last night your needs greater than ours."
"Anyway, we know it off by heart," said George. "We bequeath it to you.
We don't really need it any more."
"And what do I need with a bit of old parchment?" said Harry.
"A bit of old parchment?"
said Fred, closing his eyes with a grimace, as though Harry had mortally offended him.
"Explain, George."
"Well, when we were in our first year, Harry, young, carefree, and innocent..." Harry snorted. He doubted whether Fred and George had ever been innocent.
"Well, more innocent than we are now.
We got into a spot of bother with Filch.
We let off a dung bomb in the corridor and it upset him for some reason.
So he hauled us off to his office and started threatening us with the usual detention, disembowelment, and we couldn't help noticing a drawer in one of his filing cabinets marked confiscated and highly dangerous."
"Don't tell me," said Harry, starting to grin.
"Well, what would you have done?" said Fred.
"George caused a diversion by dropping another dung bomb. I whipped the drawer open and grabbed this."
"It's not as bad as it sounds, you know," said George. "We don't reckon Filch ever found out how to work it. He probably suspected what it was, though, or he wouldn't have confiscated it."
"And you know how to work it?"
"Oh, yes," said Fred, smirking. "This little beauty's taught us more than all the teachers in this school."
"You're winding me up," said Harry, looking at the ragged old bit of parchment.
"Oh, are we?" said George.
He took out his wand, touched the parchment lightly, and said,
"I solemnly swear that I am up to no good."
And at once thin ink lines began to spread like a spider's web from the point that George's wand had touched. They joined each other, they criss-crossed, they fanned into every corner of the parchment. Then words began to blossom across the top, great, curly, green words that proclaimed, "Messrs. Mooney, Wormtail, Padfoot and Prongs, purveyors of aids to magical mischief-makers, are proud to present The Marauder's Map." It was a map showing every detail of the Hogwarts castle and grounds. But the truly remarkable thing was the tiny ink dots moving around it, each labelled with a name in minuscule writing. Astounded, Harry bent over it. A labelled dot in the top left corner showed that Professor Dumbledore was pacing his study. The caretaker's cat, Mrs. Norris, was prowling the second floor, and Peeves the poltergeist was currently bouncing around the trophy room. And as Harry's eyes travelled up and down the familiar corridors, he noticed something else. This map showed a set of passages he had never entered, and many of them seemed to lead
"Right into Hogsmeade," said Fred, tracing one of them with his finger. "There are 7 in all. Now, Filch knows about these 4, he pointed them out, "but we're sure we're the only ones who know about these. Don't bother with the one behind the mirror on the 4th floor. We used it until last winter, but it's caved in, completely blocked. And we don't reckon anyone's ever used this one, because the Whomping Willow's planted right over the entrance. But this one here, this one, leads right into the cellar of Honeydukes. We've used it loads of times. And, as you might have noticed, the entrance is right outside this room, through that one-eyed old crone's hump."
"Moony, Wormtail, Padfoot and Prongs," sighed George, patting the heading of the map. "We owe them so much.
Noble men, working tirelessly to help a new generation of lawbreakers," said Fred solemnly. "Right," said George briskly. "Don't forget to wipe it after you've used it, or anyone can read it," Fred said warningly. "Just tap it again and say, 'Mischief managed,' and it'll go blank." "So, young Harry," said Fred, in an uncanny impersonation of Percy, "mind you behave yourself." "See you in Honeydukes," said George, winking. They left the room, both smirking in a satisfied sort of way. Harry stood there, gazing at the miraculous map. He watched the tiny ink Mrs. Norris turn left and pause to sniff at something on the floor. If Filch really didn't know, he wouldn't have to pass the Dementors at all. But even as he stood there, flooded with excitement, something Harry had once heard Mr. Weasley say came floating out of his memory. "Never trust anything that can think for itself if you can't see where it keeps its brain." This map was one of those dangerous magical objects Mr. Weasley had been warning against. Aids for magical mischief-makers. But then, Harry reasoned, he only wanted to use it to get into Hogsmeade. It wasn't as though he wanted to steal anything or attack anyone, and Fred and George had been using it for years without anything horrible happening. Harry traced the secret passage to Honeydukes with his finger. Then, quite suddenly, as though following orders, he rolled up the map, stuffed it inside his robes, and hurried to the door of the classroom. He opened it a couple of inches. There was no one outside. Very carefully, he edged out of the room and slipped behind the statue of the one-eyed witch. What did he have to do? He pulled out the map again and saw, to his astonishment, that a new ink figure had appeared upon it, labelled Harry Potter. This figure was standing exactly where the real Harry was standing, about halfway down the 3rd-floor corridor. Harry watched carefully. His little ink self appeared to be tapping the witch with his minute wand. Harry quickly took out his real wand and tapped the statue. Nothing happened. He looked back at the map. The tiniest speech bubble had appeared next to his figure. The word inside said, "Descendium." "Descendium," Harry whispered, tapping the stone witch again. At once the statue's hump opened wide enough to admit a fairly thin person. Harry glanced quickly up and down the corridor, then tucked the map away again, hoisted himself into the hole head first, and pushed himself forwards. He slid a considerable way down what felt like a stone slide, then landed on cold, damp earth. He stood up, looking around. It was pitch dark. He held up his wand, muttered, "Lumos," and saw that he was in a very narrow, low, earthy passageway. He raised the map, tapped it with the tip of his wand, and muttered, "Mischief managed." The map went blank at once. He folded it carefully, tucked it inside his robes, then, heart beating fast, both excited and apprehensive, he set off. The passage twisted and turned, more like the burrow of a giant rabbit than anything else. Harry hurried along it, stumbling now and then on the uneven floor, holding his wand out in front of him. It took ages, but Harry had the thought of Honeydukes to sustain him. After what felt like an hour, the passage began to rise. Panting, Harry sped up, his face hot, his feet very cold. 10 minutes later, he came to the foot of some worn stone steps, which rose out of sight above him. Careful not to make any noise, Harry began to climb. 100 steps. 200 steps. He lost count as he climbed, watching his feet. Then, without warning, his head hit something hard. It seemed to be a trap door. Harry stood there, massaging the top of his head, listening. He couldn't hear any sounds above him. Very slowly, he pushed the trap door open and peered over the edge. He was in a cellar which was full of wooden crates and boxes. Harry climbed out of the trap door and replaced it. It blended so perfectly with the dusty floor that it was impossible to tell it was there. Harry crept slowly towards the wooden staircase that led upstairs. Now he could definitely hear voices, not to mention the tinkle of a bell and the opening and shutting of a door. Wondering what he ought to do, he suddenly heard a door open, much closer at hand. Somebody was about to come downstairs.
"And get another box of jelly slugs, dear. They've nearly cleaned us out," said a woman's voice.
A pair of feet was coming down the staircase. Harry leapt behind an enormous crate and waited for the footsteps to pass. He heard the man shifting boxes against the wall opposite. He might not get another chance. Quickly and silently, Harry dodged out from his hiding place and climbed the stairs. Looking back, he saw an enormous backside and a shiny bald head buried in a box. Harry reached the door at the top of the stairs, slipped through it, and found himself behind the counter of Honeydukes. He ducked, crept sideways, and then straightened up. Honeydukes was so crowded with Hogwarts students that no one looked twice at Harry. He edged amongst them, looking around, and suppressed a laugh as he imagined the look that would spread over Dudley's piggy face if he could see where Harry was now. There were shelves upon shelves of the most succulent-looking sweets imaginable. Creamy chunks of nougat, shimmering pink squares of coconut ice, fat, honey-coloured toffees, hundreds of different kinds of chocolate in neat rows. There was a large barrel of every flavour beans, and another of fizzing whizbees, the levitating sherbet balls that Ron had mentioned. Along yet another wall were special effects sweets. Drubal's best blowing gum, which filled the room with bluebell-coloured bubbles that refused to pop for days. The strange, splintery, tooth-flossing string mints. Tiny black pepper imps, breathe fire for your friends. Ice mice, hear your teeth chatter and squeak. Peppermint creams shaped like toads, hop realistically in the stomach. Fragile sugar-spun quills and exploding bonbons. Harry squeezed himself through a crowd of 6th-years and saw a sign hanging in the furthest corner of the shop, Unusual Tastes. Ron and Hermione were standing underneath it, examining a tray of blood-flavoured lollipops. Harry sneaked up behind them.
"Oh, no, Harry won't want one of those. They're for vampires, I expect," Hermione was saying.
"How about these?" said Ron, shoving a jar of cockroach cluster under Hermione's nose.
"Definitely not," said Harry.
Ron nearly dropped the jar.
"Harry!" squealed Hermione. "What are you doing here? How did you—"
"Wow," said Ron, looking very impressed.
"You've learned to apparate."
"Course I haven't," said Harry. He dropped his voice so that none of the 6th-years could hear him and told them all about the Marauder's map.
"How come Fred and George never gave it to me?" said Ron, outraged. "I'm their brother."
"But Harry isn't going to keep it," said Hermione, as though the idea was ludicrous. "He's going to hand it in to Professor McGonagall, aren't you, Harry?"
"No, I'm not," said Harry.
"Are you mad?" said Ron, goggling at Hermione. "Hand in something that good?"
"If I hand it in, I'll have to say where I got it. Filch would know Fred and George nicked it."
"But what about Sirius Black?" Hermione hissed. "He could be using one of the passages on that map to get into the castle. The teachers have got to know."
"He can't be getting in through a passage," said Harry quickly. "There are 7 secret tunnels on the map, right? Fred and George reckon Filch already knows about 4 of them, and the other 3, one of them's caved in, so no one can get through it. One of them's got the Whomping Willow planted over the entrance, so you can't get out of it. And the one I just came through, well, it's really hard to see the entrance to it down in the cellar, so unless he knew it was there..."
Harry hesitated. What if Black did know the passage was there? Ron, however, cleared his throat significantly and pointed to a notice pasted on the inside of the sweet shop door. By order of the Ministry of Magic. Customers are reminded that until further notice, Dementors will be patrolling the streets of Hogsmeade every night after sundown. This measure has been put in place for the safety of Hogsmeade residents and will be lifted upon the recapture of Sirius Black. It is therefore advisable that you complete your shopping well before nightfall. Merry Christmas.
See, said Ron, quietly, I'd like to see Black try and break into Honeydukes with Dementors swarming all over the village. Anyway, Hermione, the Honeydukes' owners would hear a break-in, wouldn't they? They live over the shop.
Yes, but...
Hermione seemed to be struggling to find another problem.
Look, Harry still shouldn't be coming into Hogsmeade. He hasn't got a signed form. If anyone finds out, he'll be in so much trouble. And it's not nightfall yet. What if Sirius Black turns up today? Now?
He'd have a job spotting Harry in this, said Ron, nodding through the mullioned windows at the thick, swirling snow.
Come on, Hermione, it's Christmas. Harry deserves a break.
Hermione bit her lip, looking extremely worried. Are you going to report me? Harry asked her, grinning.
Oh, of course not, but honestly, Harry.
Seen the fizzing whizbies, Harry, said Ron, grabbing him and leading him over to their barrel.
And the jelly slugs, and the acid pops. Fred gave me one of those when I was seven. It burnt a hole right through my tongue. I remember Mum walloping him with her broomstick.
Ron stared broodingly into the acid pop box. Reckon Fred'd take a bit of cockroach cluster if I told him they were peanuts. When Ron and Hermione had paid for all their sweets, the three of them left Honeydukes for the blizzard outside. Hogsmeade looked like a Christmas card. The little thatched cottages and shops were all covered in a layer of crisp snow. There were holly wreaths on the doors and strings of enchanted candles hanging in the trees. Harry shivered. Unlike the other two, he didn't have his cloak. They headed up the street, heads bowed against the wind, Ron and Hermione shouting through their scarves.
That's the post office. Zonko's is up there. We could go up to the Shrieking Shack. Tell you what, said Ron, his teeth chattering. Shall we go for a butter beer in the Three Broomsticks?
Harry was more than willing. The wind was fierce and his hands were freezing, so they crossed the road and in a few minutes were entering the tiny inn. It was extremely crowded, noisy, warm, and smoky. A curvy sort of woman with a pretty face was serving a bunch of rowdy warlocks up at the bar.
"That's Madame Rosmerta," said Ron.
"I'll get the drinks, shall I?" he added, going slightly red. Harry and Hermione made their way to the back of the room, where there was a small vacant table between the window and a handsome Christmas tree which stood next to the fireplace. Ron came back 5 minutes later, carrying three foaming tankards of hot butter beer.
"Happy Christmas," he said happily, raising his tankard.
Harry drank deeply. It was the most delicious thing he had ever tasted, and seemed to heat every bit of him from the inside. A sudden breeze ruffled his hair. The door of the Three Broomsticks had opened again. Harry looked over the rim of his tankard and choked. Professors McGonagall and Flitwick had just entered the pub in a flurry of snowflakes, shortly followed by Hagrid, who was deep in conversation with a portly man in a lime-green bowler hat and a pinstriped cloak. Cornelius Fudge, Minister for Magic. In an instant, Ron and Hermione had both placed hands on the top of Harry's head and forced him off his stool and under the table. Dripping with butter beer and crouching out of sight, Harry clutched his empty tankard and watched the teacher's and Fudge's feet move towards the bar, pause, then turn and walk right towards him. Somewhere above him, Hermione whispered,
"Mobiliarbus!"
The Christmas tree beside their table rose a few inches off the ground, drifted sideways, and landed with a soft thump right in front of their table, hiding them from view. Staring through the dense lower branches, Harry saw four sets of chair legs move back from the table right beside theirs, then heard the grunts and sighs of the teachers and minister as they sat down. Next he saw another pair of feet, wearing sparkly turquoise high heels, and heard a woman's voice.
"A small gillywater?"
"Mine," said Professor McGonagall's voice.
4 pints of mulled mead?"
"Ta, Rosmerta," said Hagrid.
"A cherry syrup and soda with ice and umbrella?"
"Mmm,"
said Professor Flitwick, smacking his lips.
"So you'll be the red currant rum minister."
"Thank you, Rosmerta, my dear," said Fudge's voice. "Lovely to see you again, I must say. Have one yourself, won't you? Come and join us."
"Well, thank you very much, minister."
Harry watched the glittering heels march away and back again. His heart was pounding uncomfortably in his throat. Why hadn't it occurred to him that this was the last weekend of term for the teachers, too? And how long were they going to sit there? He needed time to sneak back into Honeydukes if he wanted to return to school tonight. Hermione's leg gave a nervous twitch next to him.
"So what brings you to this neck of the woods, minister?"
came Madame Rosmerta's voice. Harry saw the lower part of Fudge's thick body twist in his chair as though he was checking for eavesdroppers. Then he said, in a quiet voice,
"What else, my dear, but Sirius Black? I dare say you heard what happened up at the school at Halloween."
"I did hear a rumour," admitted Madame Rosmerta.
"Did you tell the whole pub, Hagrid?"
said Professor McGonagall exasperatedly.
"Do you think Black's still in the area, minister?"
whispered Madame Rosmerta.
"I'm sure of it," said Fudge shortly.
"You know that the Dementors have searched my pub twice," said Madame Rosmerta, a slight edge to her voice. "Scared all my customers away. It's very bad for business, minister."
"Rosmerta, my dear, I don't like them any more than you do," said Fudge uncomfortably.
"Necessary precaution. Unfortunate, but there you are. I've just met some of them. They're in a fury against Dumbledore. He won't let them inside the castle grounds."
"I should think not," said Professor McGonagall sharply. "How are we supposed to teach with those horrors floating around?"
"Hear, hear,"
squeaked tiny Professor Flitwick, whose feet were dangling a foot from the ground.
"All the same," demurred Fudge, "they are here to protect you all from something much worse. We all know what Black's capable of."
"Do you know, I still have trouble believing it," said Madame Rosmerta thoughtfully. "Of all the people to go over to the dark side, Sirius Black was the last I'd have thought. I mean, I remember him when he was a boy at Hogwarts. If you'd told me then what he was going to become, I'd have said you had too much mead."
"You don't know the half of it, Rosmerta," said Fudge gruffly.
"The worst he did isn't widely known."
"The worst?"
said Madame Rosmerta, her voice alive with curiosity.
"Worse than murdering all those poor people, you mean?"
"I certainly do," said Fudge.
"I can't believe that. What could possibly be worse?"
"You say you remember him at Hogwarts, Rosmerta," murmured Professor McGonagall. "Do you remember who his best friend was?"
"Naturally," said Madame Rosmerta with a small laugh. "Never saw one without the other, did you? The number of times I had them in here. Oh, they used to make me laugh. Quite the double act, Sirius Black and James Potter."
Harry dropped his tankard with a loud clunk. Ron kicked him.
"Precisely," said Professor McGonagall. "Black and Potter, ringleaders of their little gang, both very bright, of course, exceptionally bright, in fact, but I don't think we've ever had such a pair of troublemakers."
"I dunno," chuckled Hagrid. "Fred and George Weasley could give him a run for their money."
"You'd have thought Black and Potter were brothers,"
chimed in Professor Flitwick.
"Inseparable."
"Of course they were," said Fudge. "Potter trusted Black beyond all his other friends. Nothing changed when they left school. Black was best man when James married Lily. Then they named him godfather to Harry. Harry has no idea, of course. You can imagine how the idea would torment him."
"Because Black turned out to be in league with you-know-who,"
whispered Madame Rosmerta.
"Worse even than that, my dear."
Fudge dropped his voice and proceeded in a sort of low rumble.
"Not many people are aware that the Potters knew you-know-who was after them. Dumbledore, who was, of course, working tirelessly against you-know-who, had a number of useful spies. One of them tipped him off, and he alerted James and Lily at once. He advised them to go into hiding. Well, of course, you-know-who wasn't an easy person to hide from. Dumbledore told them that their best chance was the Fidelius charm.
How does that work?
Said Madame Rosmerta, breathless with interest. Professor Flitwick cleared his throat.
An immensely complex spell, he said squeakily, involving the magical concealment of a secret inside a single living soul. The information is hidden inside the chosen person, or secret keeper, and is henceforth impossible to find, unless, of course, the secret keeper chooses to divulge it. As long as the secret keeper refused to speak, you know who could search the village where Lily and James were staying for years and never find them. Not even if he had his nose pressed against their sitting-room window.
So Black was the Potter's secret keeper, whispered Madame Rosmerta.
Naturally, said Professor McGonagall, James Potter told Dumbledore that Black would die rather than tell where they were, that Black was planning to go into hiding himself, and yet Dumbledore remained worried. I remember him offering to be the Potter's secret keeper himself.
He suspected Black, gasped Madame Rosmerta.
He was sure that somebody close to the Potters had been keeping you-know-who informed of their movements, said Professor McGonagall darkly. Indeed, he had suspected for some time that someone on our side had turned traitor and was passing a lot of information to you-know-who.
But James Potter insisted on using Black.
He did, said Fudge heavily, and then, barely a week after the Fidelius charm had been performed,
Black betrayed them,
breathed Madame Rosmerta.
He did indeed.
Black was tired of his double-agent role. He was ready to declare his support openly for you-know-who, and he seems to have planned this for the moment of the Potter's death. But as we all know, you-know-who met his downfall in little Harry Potter. Powers gone, horribly weakened, he fled, and this left Black in a very nasty position indeed. His master had fallen at the very moment when he, Black, had shown his true colours as a traitor. He had no choice but to run for it.
"Filthy, stinking turncoat!"
Hagrid said so loudly that half the bar went quiet.
"Shh!" said Professor McGonagall.
"I met him," growled Hagrid. I must have been the last to see him before he killed all them people. It was me what rescued Harry from Lily and James' house after they was killed. Just got him out of the ruins, poor little thing, with a great slash across his forehead, and his parents dead, and Sirius Black turns up on that flying motorbike he used to ride. Never occurred to me what he was doing there. I didn't know he'd been Lily and James's secret keeper. Thought he'd just heard the news of you-know-who's attack, and come to see what he could do. White and shaken he was. And you know what I did? I comforted the murdering traitor!
Hagrid roared.
Hagrid, please, said Professor McGonagall, keep your voice down.
How was I to know he wasn't upset about Lily and James? It was you-know-who he cared about. And then he says, give Harry to me, Hagrid. I'm his godfather. I'll look after him. Ha! But I'd had me orders from Dumbledore, and I told Black no. Dumbledore said Harry was to go to his aunt and uncle's. Black argued, but in the end he gave in. Told me to take his motorbike to get Harry there. I won't need it any more, he says. I should have known there was something fishy going on then. He loved that motorbike. What was he giving it to me for? Why wouldn't he need it any more? Fact was, it was too easy to trace. Dumbledore knew he'd been the Potter's secret keeper. Black knew he was going to have to run for it that night, knew it was a matter of hours before the Ministry was after him. But what if I'd given Harry to him, eh? I bet he'd have pitched him off the bike halfway out to sea, his best friend's son. But when a wizard goes over to the dark side, there's nothing and no one that matters to him any more.
A long silence followed Hagrid's story. Then Madame Rosmerta said with some satisfaction,
"But he didn't manage to disappear, did he? The Ministry of Magic caught up with him next day."
"Alas, if only we had," said Fudge bitterly. "It was not we who found him. It was little Peter Pettigrew, another of the Potter's friends. Maddened by grief, no doubt, and knowing that Black had been the Potter's secret keeper, he went after Black himself."
"Pettigrew? That fat little boy who was always tagging around after them at Hogwarts?" said Madame Rosmerta.
"Hero worshipped Black and Potter," said Professor McGonagall. "Never quite in their league, talent-wise. I was often rather sharp with him. You can imagine how I regret that now."
She sounded as though she had a sudden head cold.
"There now, Minerva," said Fudge kindly. "Pettigrew died a hero's death. Eyewitnesses, muggles, of course, we wiped their memories later, told us how Pettigrew cornered Black. They say he was sobbing. 'Lily and James, Sirius, how could you?' And then he went for his wand. Well, of course, Black was quicker. Blew Pettigrew to smithereens."
Professor McGonagall blew her nose and said thickly,
"Stupid boy. Foolish boy. He was always hopeless at duelling. Should have left it to the ministry."
"I tell you, if I'd got to Black before little Pettigrew did, I wouldn't have messed around with wands. I'd have ripped him limb from limb," Hagrid growled.
"You don't know what you're talking about, Hagrid," said Fudge sharply. "Nobody but trained hit wizards from the magical law enforcement squad would have stood a chance against Black once he was cornered. I was junior minister in the Department of Magical Catastrophes at the time, and I was one of the first on the scene after Black murdered all those people. I will never forget it. I still dream about it sometimes. A crater in the middle of the street, so deep it had cracked the sewer below. Bodies everywhere, muggles screaming, and Black standing there, laughing, with what was left of Pettigrew in front of him, a heap of blood-stained robes and a few fragments."
Fudge's voice stopped abruptly. There was the sound of five noses being blown.
"Well, there you have it, Rosmerta," said Fudge thickly. "Black was taken away by 20 members of the Magical Law Enforcement Patrol, and Pettigrew received the Order of Merlin, first class, which I think was some comfort to his poor mother. Black's been in Azkaban ever since."
Madame Rosmerta let out a long sigh.
"Is it true he's mad, Minister?" "I wish I could say that he was," said Fudge slowly. "I certainly believe his master's defeat unhinged him for a while. The murder of Pettigrew and all those muggles was the action of a cornered and desperate man, cruel, pointless. Yet I met Black on my last inspection of Azkaban. You know, most of the prisoners in there sit muttering to themselves in the dark. There's no sense in them. But I was shocked at how normal Black seemed. He spoke quite rationally to me. It was unnerving. You'd have thought he was merely bored. Asked if I'd finished with my newspaper, cool as you please. Said he missed doing the crossword. Yes, I was astounded at how little effect the Dementors seemed to be having on him. And he was one of the most heavily guarded in the place, you know. Dementors outside his door day and night." "But what do you think he's broken out to do?" said Madame Rosmerta. "Good gracious, Minister, he isn't trying to rejoin you-know-who, is he?"
"I dare say that is his eventual plan," said Fudge evasively. "But we hope to catch Black long before that. I must say, you know who alone and friendless is one thing, but give him back his most devoted servant, and I shudder to think how quickly he'll rise again." There was a small chink of glass on wood. Someone had set down their glass.
"You know, Cornelius, if you're dining with the headmaster, we'd better head back up to the castle," said Professor McGonagall.
One by one, the pairs of feet in front of Harry took the weight of their owners once more. Hems of cloaks swung into sight, and Madame Rosmerta's glittering heels disappeared behind the bar. The door of the Three Broomsticks opened again. There was another flurry of snow, and the teachers disappeared.
"Harry?"
Ron and Hermione's faces appeared under the table. They were both staring at him, lost for words.